Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. A burning question for every avid reader is, what should I read next? A neglected classic? The latest bestseller? Perhaps it's time to reread something I remember fondly or can't remember at all. When you next face this dilemma, there's a new place to turn to. Veteran bookseller James Mustick has curated an eclectic list of 1,000 great books of all types, from The Odyssey to the 9/11 Commission Report to Goodnight Moon, and accompanied each of them with a brief essay and further recommendations. So whatever your age or taste, you're sure to find something that you'll want to read. 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, a life-changing list, is published by Workman Publishing, and I'm very pleased that it brings James Mustick to our show now. Hi.
I'm glad to be here.
Isn't this a rather ambitious project for a first book?
Yes, it is. It took me 14 years to write it. So, which was not my intent when I started, but it just getting bigger and bigger. And as you know, every year there are new books being published, and in the tens of thousands, and there are new horizons for anyone as a reader.
And even classics, sometimes if they're in a foreign language, there are new translations.
Absolutely, there's new translations. And it was for the time I was writing on the book, I write in the introduction, once people know you are writing a book called 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, you can never enjoy a dinner party in quite the same way again. So I'd come home from every social encounter with new books to add to the list.
And I'm sure, well, when we met before we went on the air, I asked her about a few books, we're not going to mention them, to see if they had been included because I couldn't find them in the book.
Right.
It's impossible to, maybe it should have been 1,500.
Yes, it could have been 1,500. It could have been 2,000. For a long time, it seemed like a lot as I was writing it. But as I got towards the end of the project, you know, I realized how much had to be left out.
Workman Publishing had a hit with a very popular book called 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. So I'm assuming that was part of one of the inspirations here?
Well, the idea was Peter Workman, who conceived of 1,000 Places and was the founding publisher of Workman, who sadly passed away a few years ago. After the success of 1,000 Places, we were talking one day and he said, I'd love to do one about books. Neither he nor I had the intention that it was going to take quite so long, but it did.
I'm trying to think of some of the other topics that they could do 1,000.
They've done for recordings.
1,000 dishes.
Well, there's 1,000 foods to eat before you die. They did that with by Mimi Sheridan, and the recordings book by Tom Moon is a favorite of mine.
When you worked in a bookstore, did you enjoy matching customers with books that you thought they would enjoy?
Yes, I love that, especially readers who were adventurous or not stuck in a rut. Lots of readers, and this is certainly a lot of the pleasure of reading, like to stay in a single groove. But readers who were looking for something new or to explore areas that they felt that they needed a little push towards or some guidance towards, I love that very much.
And then there was a mail order book catalog, A Common Reader.
Right.
That was, how long did you do that?
I did that for 20 years. Co-founded that in 1986 and ran it for 20 years. And that was a catalog where we wrote about books very personally, the personal recommendation. We tried to find books that were off the beaten path, not on the bestseller list, that people might not come upon. In those days, it was before there was any internet book selling. So we were really like a book blog and a social community of books, but Al Gore had yet to invent the internet, and we did it all in a mail order catalog.
And naming it that, A Common Reader, you're kind of paying tribute to Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf, who was paying tribute to Samuel Johnson, who uses the phrase in one of his Lives of the Poets about the verdict of the common reader being the ultimate judge of the value of a work.
Well, I've always wondered whether the common reader is the best judge.
Well, you know, I'm not sure, but I do believe there is a...
Otherwise, bestsellers would be the only good books.
Well, over time, you know, if you look at the reason the Odyssey, which you mentioned, or the Aeneid, or the Tale of Genji are still around is they've been crowdsourced for a really long time, and they continue to repay people's attention.
Yeah, then you also began publishing on your own under the Alcadine Press imprint.
Right, Alcadine Press. Mm-hmm.
Did you specialize in out-of-print books?
We did. What we found when we were running the catalog, we built up a mailing list of subscribers that was between 200,000 and 300,000 people that we'd mail to every month. And what happened is we would get letters and emails from our customers about books that they had discovered in our catalog, but also about books that weren't in the catalog that they thought we should know about. And their passionate advocacy for the books they loved, as well as our own favorites that we couldn't get from a publisher to sell, led us to, we published about 150 books.
What are some of the ones you were pleased to reintroduce?
One was called, one of my own favorite books is a book called A Mass for the Dead by a writer named William Gibson. Not the William Gibson who's famous now as a science fiction writer, but this William Gibson is probably most famous for having written the play The Miracle Worker about...
That's the one I was thinking.
Yes.
And
this book is a memoir about growing up in the metropolitan area in modest circumstances and about how he kind of became a little estranged from his parents and then reconnected. It's a marvelous book.
There are still a lot of books... worthy books out of print. New York Review Books is has picked up the picked that up, and they're now publishing a whole bunch of them, especially new translations.
Yes, the New York Review of Books Classics is doing a fantastic job, run by Edwin Frank, who's a great publisher. And in fact,
and a former guest on the show.
I just bumped into him on the train yesterday as he was coming. We were both coming into Manhattan after the weekend. And they've done many books. They've actually done a few books that we had republished, and then we went out of business. But A Time to Keep Silence by Patrick Lee Fermor, Aikenfield by Ronald Blythe, they've republished. But particularly in recent years, the work they've done with translation has been visionary and of great, great value.
Sometimes they've assigned a translation, which is...
Yes.
Something you couldn't have done when you had your little press.
Exactly.
There have been numerous previous guides for readers, from the Harvard Classics to Lifetime Reading Plan. What was your approach?
Well, it took me a while to come up with the approach, actually. That's part of what took so long. I started building many lists of books to include as wide a range as I could. But then to try to come up with an organizing principle that did two things, would keep it serendipitous to browse, because part of what I wanted the book to be about was really why reading is important to us, which is more than the individual books. And part of that is the pleasure of discovery when you come upon something in a bookstore or in a library that isn't the thing you were looking for, but your mind connects with it.
So do you think that the decline of the number of brick-and-mortar bookstores has changed the reading experience?
I don't think it's changed the reading experience. I think it has led to a more of an appreciation of that kind of environment. You see
we can't browse anymore. It's great that we have so many books available to us online.
But the browsing is not the same, exactly.
How many books did I buy? I can think of any number. I remember one, which we'll talk about a little later. I was walking down Fourth Avenue in the old days when there were a lot of bookstores there, and I came upon this book that I'd never heard of, and it was a paperback, and it was going to cost me 25 cents, and the blurb was one of the most important unread books in the English language, André Gide. Oh. And I thought, well, if André Gide thinks this is a good book, and it turned out to be one of my favorites. I'm glad that it's included in your selection here.
Good.
James Hogg's Confessions and Memoirs of a Justified Sinner.
That's a wild book.
Yeah. And when when I mention that book to a lot of educated people, they have no idea that it exists. But if I mention it to any Scottish writers, mm-hmm. they all say, that's the beginning of Scottish literature.
Yes, yes. It's a marvelous book, and it would be, I think, it should have a new life. I mean, I know it's in print in various editions, but more people should know it, for
well,
sure.
Because here we are talking about an early 19th century novel that's written from in first person by a man who's going crazy.
Yes.
This is before Dostoevsky ever
exactly.
came up with the idea.
Exactly. It is reminiscent of Dostoevsky, but it has a particular Scottish lilt to it, shall we say, that makes it special. And that whole thing about browsing, so when I was thinking about the book, coming out of the Thousand Places book, which you talked about, I would joke with the author of that book, Patricia Schultz, that conceptually, at least, her job was easy. You take a map in terms of organization, and you could go from continent to continent. But for a book about 1,000 books could be many different things. It could be a canon of alleged classics. It could be a tour of human thought and all its disciplines, which a book contain. It could be organized by the age of the reader or by the subject or chronologically. All of those seem to me to work against, again, this quality of serendipity I was after. So I finally, there's a quote in a book by Edmund Wilson where he talks about the miscellaneous learning of the bookstore, unorganized by any larger principle. And that's what I went after. So I said, what if I had a bookstore? I only had 1,000 books, but I wanted something
for
every
reading. So you were stocking an imaginary bookstore.
Yeah,
here.
That's how I finally got to where I ended up.
With only 1,000 books.
Yes.
You also enjoy in this pointing out unexpected connections. In the entry for Giuseppe Tomasi de Lampedusa's The Leopard, which is set in Sicily just before the unification of Italy, you suggest the reader might also like Gone with the Wind, because that's also about the end of a way of life.
Yes, exactly. Very different books, but there's something about the kind of nostalgia and the kind of decline of an aristocracy and all that implies on all the social classes is common to both books.
On the other hand, would you say one of those books was better than the other?
Well, I think The Leopard, if I had to choose one, would be
one of the greatest mine. Books
yes,
of the 20th
magnificent,
century.
A magnificent book, yes.
And Burt Lancaster was great in the movie.
He was, yeah. The movie's very interesting, actually, because there's several different versions
well,
of
Visconti,
it.
Well, Visconti, so you yes. have another level there.
Yep.
In your introduction, you write that readers read the way that they eat for pleasure as well as nourishment.
Well, you know, I know that for me, someday I'm happy with a tuna fish sandwich. The next day I'd be happy with a fine French meal. The next night I might want sushi. And I think our reading lives are more like that than organized with an eye to nutrition or something. Taste really has a lot, and taste in the moment. So I wanted somebody to take my book and not read it to end, but to open it anywhere and browse around until, you know, they had the equivalent thing of saying, yeah, that book is, it feels like what I want to have for dinner tonight. This is my reading dinner.
And we get different things from different kinds of books.
Absolutely.
Some books set off light bulbs in our minds. Mm-hmm. Others are just the sheer pleasure of getting caught up in a world.
Absolutely. And you mentioned in your introduction, returning to books we've read before, finding the pleasures of comfort there, or having a totally different point of view on them is really part of the fun.
In the case of that James Hogg book that I mentioned earlier, I had been recommending it for years, so I decided at a certain point, I better read this book again and make sure that I'm not making a mistake. And I thought it was better the second time I read it than it was the first time.
Well, I just had that experience because through the latter part of the fall, I was touring around the country to many independent bookstores and libraries talking about the book. And people would and people would ask, you know, what are some of your favorites, if you had to name three or five. And one of them I talked about all the time was George Eliot's Middlemarch, mm-hmm. which has been my favorite novel.
It's a great book.
When I got home from the tour, I said, I'm going to reread it now and, you know, see how it holds up. And again, it's, as you just said about The Hog, it's even better.
I'm speaking with James Mustich, M-U-S-T-I-C-H. about his book from Workman Publishing called 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, a life-changing list. We'll get into whether it can change your life. This is WBAI, a life-changing radio station in New York, 99.5 FM. Graham Greene divided the books he wrote into novels and entertainments. Do you make a similar distinction between literature and genre?
I make a distinction in my own mind between literature and story, where we're driven to see, we want to find out what happens next, and that takes the, that is the main impetus that pulls us through a book. Literature can be more artful, can be more architectural, can engage ideas in a more integrated way. Those two strands can cross one another, as in the Odyssey and in many other books. But I think I know in my own reading life, there are times when you want a story that's going to pull you through. And then there's other times when you want something that you can ponder and appreciate in a different way. So I think there is a distinction, but not always one of quality. It's of intent and shape, I think.
So you began with a goal of 1,000 books, which probably struck you as a daunting number, but you had to start somewhere.
Yes.
Did you incorporate the entries you'd written for the Common Reader Catalog?
The entries for the Common Reader Catalog were often shorter than the essays in 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, but I did find many seeds for the essays that I wrote, you know, the approach or the angle that I took to our book, or I said something that I thought was worth saving.
And what were you hoping to achieve with those essays? To excite people about the prospect of reading that book?
I wanted the entries to feel like an invitation and to be welcoming rather than overwhelming. I think people are daunted by reading sometimes, especially when it comes to classics or books they've heard about for a long time. And I wanted to write in a way that was inviting, to say, here's the context for the book. This is why it's important. To give a little bit of a synopsis, but not really a synopsis, to give a reader's view of a weighing of the book and why it would repay your attention to do it. And often, in terms of the classics, I try to find a particular passage that would spark that interest.
Did you limit the number of classics? You include Homer, Plato, Shakespeare, but was it important to diversify beyond the obvious choices?
Yes, but in terms of the classics, that wasn't that hard to do. You know, in my mind, I had a kind of structure of maybe 250 of the books people might expect to see in terms of classics, and then others that could be arguable, and there could be an equal number not in there. So I think I covered it pretty broadly.
And how many did you try to allot numbers to different categories? How many books of science fiction, mysteries, food?
I did it more by feel, saying, I want more of this. When I got to the last 150 or so, I did a retrospective on what I had and made some decisions about I wanted to add a few books that were a little more lighthearted and things like that, or more books for children, because children's books are in here too. It's really meant to be a lifetime look. So I didn't have a hard and fast rule, but again, the metaphor that I gave you before about the store, I wanted, my idea was if you're walking around, there should be some of this, and is there enough for the sum to have a shelf or not?
And stores put their books on the shelves in alphabetical order.
Yes.
And that's what you decided to do here, alphabetically by author?
I did alphabetically by author, with the exception of maybe a dozen books. The Bible, the Quran, the Book of Common Prayer, that didn't have Beowulf, that didn't have an identifiable author, Epic of Gilgamesh. But most of them are alphabetical by author. And I did that, one, because it's people are oriented right away. You know, they know the alphabet. But more importantly, any other arrangement that I tried, because I'd sort and resort the titles.
You could have done fiction and nonfiction, plays, poetry.
But I wanted
short stories.
I wanted there to be more of a sense of surprise. So I'll give you an example. In the tease in the book, there's a book by a man named Darcy Wentworth Thompson called On Growth and Form, which was written around the turn of the 20th century. And it's a book about his observations of nature. It's part aesthetics, part natural science. It's become something of an inspiration to designers as well as to scientists. And that's followed by a book by a woman named Flora Thompson called Lark Rise to Candleford, which is a lovely evocation of growing up in the English countryside. It's genteel, sedate, gentle, just lovely. And that's followed by Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So that kind of, yes, so that kind of juxtaposition where people were going to find things they weren't expecting, I felt would be part of the fun of the book, to make the book fun to browse around in, and also to get people out of their habits. So they didn't just go to mysteries or military history, but would go to a book that they loved and then perhaps be surprised by what was before and after it.
I'm assuming that you'd already read most of the 1,000 books before you started the project, but how much research did you have to do to put this all together and to write short essays, on which are almost a book review for each book?
Well, to write something short, I think it was Mark Twain who once said, in his correspondence somewhere, he says, "I'm writing you this long letter because I don't have enough time to write you a short one." To make things short takes time. And also, there was a lot of research, one, to recall what the book was and the feel of the book. There's half of the book is fiction and half nonfiction, so there are a lot of subject areas. I wanted to make sure I had my facts right. And I also, when you're writing something about a work, especially something that's been around for a long time, you have to know enough to know what not to say, not just what to say, but what not to say.
But you give clues with these subtitles. For example, the entry for The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins is subtitled, "A Meme is Born." Right. And you've called William Golding's Lord of the Flies entry, "Boys Will Be Boys." So we get an awful lot of the story without you having to explain it.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, that's part of as I said, about the invitation. I wanted it to be fun because I discovered something that was really driven home to me since I've been talking about the book since it's been published. You mentioned that the series from Workman started with 1,000 places to see before you die. And that's more of a, just as people approach it, people don't think they're going to go to 1,000 places. So it's kind of like a fantasy catalog, you know, and it's kind of freeing in a way to wander through that wonderful book. With books, I've been surprised by the number of people who've taken this and said, "I'm going to read all 1,000 books," you know, and it's kind of daunting.
They probably have read a few already.
Well, yeah, but it's daunting in that way. And my advice to people is to just open it anywhere or go to a book that you hope is in there or you think might be in there, read about that, see if I know what I'm talking about, and then browse around and see what you find.
Well, since books have played such an important role in your life, what will we learn about you when we spend time reading about your recommendations?
Well, that's a good question. As I got towards the end of the project, it dawned on me that part of what I was doing in writing this book was leaving for my daughters, who are both grown and in their 20s now, a record of what made me. You know, who made me what I was. You referred to Fourth Avenue and browsing around in the bookstores there. You used to be able to in New York City.
Incredible is only the Strand survives.
Yes,
now.
Exactly. And those bookstores really gave me an orientation to life and thought that this book isn't, you know, in some ways a record of, that this is the landscape in which I grew up. And so I think you'd learn a lot about me. There's not a lot that's expressed personally in the book, but just from the choices and the themes that I choose to elaborate on, I think there's a lot of me in the book.
Why have you subtitled it A Life-Changing List?
Well, it is.
You really think people's lives will be changed by reading these 1,000 books?
I think people's lives are changed by reading, because, or you know, it might be more exact to say, although not quite as pithy for the cover of the book, our lives are shaped by reading, because reading is how we learn how to elaborate the most important ongoing conversation we have, which is the conversation that goes on inside our heads. So these books, as they feed that conversation, they nourish a life and they shape it in a way that I think is important.
But for people who really love books,
yes,
there's rarely enough space to keep them all unless you just have bookshelves all over your house. Right now, because I had to clear out an office at another radio station and then moved to another place, I would say about one-third of my books, and this is with a fair amount of bookshelves, one-third of them are in boxes.
Yeah.
And some of them are really good books.
Exactly. I'm sure you had this experience as you were doing that purge. We often, my wife and I, we'll go and look at a bookshelves. We have bookshelves down in the basement, wall-to-wall bookshelves. And we'll say, we're going to spend some time now culling from here. And you'll go down for 2 hours, and you'll come back with like 2 books. you say, we can get rid of
these. Sometimes I offer people the opportunity to go through a box and take something. Well, and then I'm usually disappointed with the books that they've chosen. They're not the ones I would have taken. But that's a whole other issue. Did many people offer advice on which books you should include? Did you include some of your wife's favorites?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact. My favorite story, though, is I was, as I said, every time we were at a social occasion or at a dinner party, any reader who heard what I was up to would come and speak to me. And I was speaking to a woman on one of these occasions, and we're talking about travel books, about travel to Italy. Mm-hmm. And she said, do you know what the best travel book to Italy is, about travel in Italy? And I said, you know, I had a short list in my head. I've been a bookseller for 3 or 4 decades at that point. And she mentioned a book that not only wasn't on my list, I had never heard of, and I had never heard of the author. It's a book called The Surprise of Cremona by a woman named Edith Templeton, written in the mid to late 1950s. And it's a woman who goes and visits alone, traveling alone, all the smaller cities. So Cremona, Ravenna, Urbino, Mantua, Padua. And it is a marvelous book. And it is, in fact, the best travel book now that I've ever read about Italy. So that made its way into the book.
As soon as I got your book, I looked up some of my favorites, and I was pleased that you had Journey to the End of Night by Louis Ferdinand Céline, Epitaph of a Small Winter by Joaquin Maria Machado de Assis. You had one of my brother Philip's books, The Art of the Personal Essay.
It was a marvelous book.
But you didn't have books that I would have included, mm-hmm. including The Makioka Sisters by Junichiro Tanizaki. Yes. You didn't have one of two of the great Chinese classics, Dream of the Red Chamber, and also Journey to the East. Are you a little less read up on Eastern literature?
Yes, I'm not as well versed in Eastern literature. There's some in the book, but those are gaps that I.
Well, is there any plan to do a second edition?
Well, you know, I've come to call it the Afterlife Edition, but we've actually given me the opportunity to say we've built a website, 1000bookstoread.com. That's 1000bookstoread.com. Mm. And people can go there and they'll see my list. They can review my little, I don't have the full essays, but a couple of sentences. And there's 3 buttons. You can click agree that this is a book everybody should read before they die. The second button says life's too short. I don't want to read this. And the third button is you can comment or you can add it to your own want to read list. You can comment on the books, but importantly, you can also add your own books. So part of the impetus for me in doing the book was to foster that conversation.
I was so intrigued by your description of a book I'd never heard of, A Part of Myself by Carl Zuckmeier. So I looked it up on Amazon, and there's only one copy available. It is $631. So if you decide to go back to the business of reprinting books, that might be something to start with.
Well, the same thing is true of the book I mentioned before, The Surprise of Cremona. It's very expensive in used copies online. I think my talking about it has made it even more so. But that's you know, part of the pleasure of those bookstores in the Fourth Avenue days. Is as a reader, you would walk around with a list of books you'd been looking for a long time in your head. And when you came upon it, it was really like finding a little pot of gold at the end of a rainbow. And that part of that joy has dissipated because books are easier to find online. But it's good to have some that aren't readily available.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. What was your policy on more than one book by the same author?
There's about 36 authors who have more than one book represented.
But because somebody like Dostoevsky, who wrote so many books,
yes,
you couldn't list them all.
I tried to find things that I felt to be representative. So for Dostoevsky, it's Crime and Punishment, because it is really the perhaps his masterpiece and really the birth of a kind of psychological novel, although the James Hogg book we were talking about before precedes it. So it's a very important work. And then The Brothers Karamazov, because it broadened the themes to the kind of religious things he was interested in. And then I also included Notes from Underground, which is a particularly intense version of the Dostoevskian vision.
And one that spoke to me when I was a young reader.
Yes.
And felt, a kindred spirit. But you do have Jane Austen, a great writer.
Yep.
Although I think most readers would agree that all of her books aren't of equal quality, but you decided to include all six.
Well, Jane Austen, as Dostoevsky was so influential in terms of the psychological novel, it's, in my estimation, and certainly not mine alone, Jane Austen invented a kind of, not just a novel of manners, but the you might even say the romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And her books were weightier than many romantic comedies. But in inventing that kind of form, she is probably has the largest footprint in English for influence. So I wanted to pay suitable homage to her.
You didn't always pick the author's most famous book. Was it the one that you liked the most? For example, you highlight Hilary Mantel's novel about the French Revolution, A Place of Greater Safety, but not her better-known Wolf Hall.
Well, part of that is the kind of nerdy bookseller in me coming out, where you see a writer who writes a book that gets great acclaim and well-deserved. Certainly no slight meant for Wolf Hall.
One of my great thrills was I once interviewed her.
Yeah, and a brilliant writer in all her books. And I don't think enough people know about her earlier books. And the one about the French Revolution spoke to me particularly. And also, I found Wolf Hall at the start difficult to get into, to get oriented. So I thought for a reader unfamiliar with her work, Great Place of Greater Safety might be a better start.
So when one starts to read an unfamiliar author, is it important which book you start with?
Well, I think, as I was saying before, our appetites fluctuate and our interests fluctuate. It's important to read the one that speaks to you at the moment, and that might not be the greatest work. Garcia Marquez has a marvelous passage in one of his interviews where he talks about Hemingway's Across the River and Into the Trees as being his favorite of Hemingway's book. Ooh. Because it's in a way, you have to, it's him at his worst, and he still loved it.
He had lines like he loved her true.
And but saying that you can appreciate an author or a composer not only at their highest points.
Did you include any books that you personally disliked but that you thought were important?
Yes, Atlas Shrugged is a book that I have no affection for.
And most people would not consider it great literature. It's influential.
It has been tremendously influential. So I wanted to tackle it in a way and say something about it.
Well, but if the criterion is how influential a book is, why not include Mein Kampf?
It wasn't my only criterion, but certainly it's a part of the conversation now. And Atlas Shrugged, if you look at some years ago, the Modern Library did the 100 most influential novels, and then they crowdsourced one, and Atlas Shrugged was at the top of the list. So it's part of the mind of America in the past few decades.
You include the Epic of Gilgamesh, as you mentioned earlier,
yes.
Originally encoded on tablets in Babylon 4,000 years ago.
Correct.
Guess that's the oldest book in circulation.
Yes.
What are some of the newer ones here?
Well, speaking of code, the most recent one is a book called Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology by Ellen Ullman, which is a marvelous book of essays. Ullman was a software coder in the early days of Silicon Valley, one of the few women in that role at the time, but she's also a marvelous writer. She wrote a book, I think it was in 1998, called Close to the Machine, which is kind of like a coder's view of how they go about their work, which became something of a cult classic. But Life in Code is a thoughtful evocation of what the world of technology means to us, beautifully written. And you come upon ideas that really are provocative. And that was published in 2017. So that's the most recent.
I was pleased to see another of my favorite contemporary writers represented, Jennifer Egan, with
yes.
a visit from the Goon Squad,
yes.
a Brooklyn native. And here we are
exactly.
talking about books in Brooklyn. Do you think it was important to diversify, to select authors who represent different races and nationalities, time periods?
Of course, yes.
Male and female. There were no women authors for many millennia. So
yes,
that
so
made it a little more difficult.
Skews the tally, but I certainly think it's important, and I think it is. There's so much rich publishing being done now that's more diverse than in the past few decades, and I think it's. I did my best to keep up with it. I failed, you know, because it's just there's too much incoming, but I was conscious of it for sure.
Actually, most of the, you mentioned Tale of Genji.
Yes.
More great women were writing books in other countries and in Asia.
Yes.
Lady Murasaki wrote that. The Dream of the Red Chambers, written by a woman.
The Pillow Book, yeah. also, by the same period there. And there's some of the, one of the favorite discoveries for me is the writing of Madame de Stael. Mm-hmm. There's one of her novels, and none of her books really quite does justice to what a genius she was, but a marvelous book called Corrine or Italy, which is first real romantic hero in literature. It's the woman title about a decade before Lord Byron.
Now, we read all of those in translation, and
yes.
there are challenges of reading in translation. Each generation seems to produce a new translation of the classics. Is it better to read a translation that was prepared closer to the time that the books were written, as some people argue?
I can't say if it's better or worse. I believe that some works in their translations themselves become works in their own right, almost. It's certainly.
Well, you're never really reading what the author wrote.
Right.
You're reading what the translator wrote. Right. And if the sentences are beautiful, it's because the translator writes beautiful sentences.
Exactly. So it's hard to say. And you also, when you're reading, translation is interesting, especially contemporary translation, because even though publishing, it may make publishing here more diverse, there's still a filter on it that some editor is looking for something that's going to play to a market here. So you don't know how much of a view into another country's literature you're actually getting. But the translation question is an open one. I love coming upon new translations. For instance, the translations of Virgil's Aeneid that I have is by a woman named Sarah Rudin, which is just spectacular. It's just out in the past couple of years, and it is concise in its language in the way that Virgil himself is, unlike to a higher degree than any other more fable translations I ever found.
Did you ever just compare?
Yes, I did. Yes.
One of the more problematic translators was Constance Garnett. Some people swear by her translations because they're so beautifully written, even if sometimes she gets a few things wrong. You chose the 2007 translation of War and Peace by Richard Pevere and Larissa Volkhansky over her Garnett's 1904 translation.
That, in part, it's because I found the style a little more congenial to me, a little fresher than the Constance Garnett one, but also because I had the good fortune some years ago to actually, when that book came out, that translation, to do a very long interview with the translators. So I got part of their, their advocacy for their own approach to it, which I found quite compelling and convincing.
It's interesting when you read some of these great books in different translations that you're really reading different books.
Exactly.
Because the translator also probably was attracted to the work in the first place because of certain personal affinities.
Indeed. And I remember in the conversation I had with Richard Prevere, he was talking about their first, their translation of Anna Karenina, which was a big success. When they sent it off to I believe it was the British publisher, it was copy edited and sent back to him, and it was unrecognizable because it was rendered in a clean kind of strunk and white English style with no character to it. And he had to revert everything because he was insistent
to catch the flavor of the book.
That they were taking the Tolstoy out of the book. So,
well, I could only imagine what would happen if Tolstoy had sent the original manuscript into that editor.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
A favorite section is the miscellany of special lists in which you group together 12 books that you can read in one sitting.
Right. There's about two dozen lists or so, books to read in one sitting. On that list are Candide by Voltaire, a lovely book, a reminiscence by a woman named Eileen Beckerman called Love, Loss, and What I Wore, where she takes 60 outfits from her Brownie uniform through a Prada bag that she buys at the behest of her granddaughter and has little vignettes about it. And then there's other lists, 12 books to read before you're 12, books to share with the family to read out loud, 12 terrific audiobooks, because so many of us these days rely on audiobooks and their quality is quite good now. So,
some cases.
Yes, in some, indeed.
You include a number of books for children. Were they the ones that you read to your kids or the ones that
mostly,
you read when you were a kid?
Mostly the ones I read to my kids, a few from my own childhood.
Because Jack and Jane, who I think is, was it Jack and Jane? Anyway, the things that I had to read when I was a kid were not great literature.
No.
We didn't have Good Night Moon yet.
Right.
So you mentioned earlier that, how about Nick Hornby's?
Yes.
He has a monthly column that he has broken up into two sections, books bought and books read.
Exactly. I love that column. As a matter of fact, there was a book of collections of those columns called 10 Years in the Tub, which I include in my book. I have a section of books on books, just in case 1,000 aren't enough for you. And Hornby's book is in there. And that feature of his column, books bought versus books read, I found, again, true to our real reading lives. You know, you go into a bookstore and bring home 8 books, and you're not going to get through them all in the next few weeks.
But Nick Hornby is a well-known novelist in his own right,
yes.
So it's interesting to see what appeals to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which might be different than a different writer, or writer of nonfiction,
exactly.
Who we admire.
Yep.
I suspect Robert Caro's reading list is very different than Nick Hornby's.
I would suspect so, yes.
So you mentioned that you have a website, 1000bookstoread.com. 1000 Books to Read is one word.
Right.
And it's
numbers, 1000.
Now, what kind of feedback are you getting from your readers?
I must say I am delighted and gratified that most of the reception that I've gotten to the book has been very welcoming, and then great advocacy for the things I've left out, but in almost universally a polite and collegial way. So it's lovely.
And did you feel the ones, you know, it's almost understood that you're going to leave things out.
Yes.
But were some of those things, did it give a little pang of guilt? Oh, gee, how could I have
yes. Overlooked that one? I spent 14 years writing the book, and I expect to spend the next 14 finding out what I got wrong and feeling bad about it. You write this book is a 1,000 pages long. It's half a million words. I worked on it for 14 years, and every day something happens where I see a book or somebody mentions a book that makes me feel like a slacker.
How about libraries and bookstores? Are they using the Before You Die concept to get people thinking about what they should read?
Yes. We had marvelous events through September, October, and November in libraries around the country and bookstores. And libraries have been particularly inventive in taking the book and then surrounding it with books that are in it. And whenever I went to a library and saw that, I said, you should have another selection of all the books you as librarians think should have been in it that aren't, you know? So part of promoting that conversation is what I was after in writing the book.
And getting back to the books that you didn't include, you can always, nowadays, you could just put them in a new list online.
Well, what I'm hoping to do...
Would you write little essays for them as well?
What I'm hoping to do with the website is to collect lots of books like that and put together lists with, if not essays, with some annotations that just give people what's the context for this book. And that's what it's something I very much hope to do in the next year or so.
Some years ago when I was speaking to A.S. Byatt, she was complaining about... BBC interview shows where they would put it together with three other leading writers of fiction and ask, has the novel died? Do you think that the novel has died or any of the important genres have died? Because right now the focus does seem to be more and more on nonfiction.
Yes, I think I don't believe the novel has died. I don't think it will die. I think it's interesting to me that it seems to be most invigorated in either not in English or in English, but not in the UK or the US, coming from Africa and the Asian subcontinent. A real richness of novelistic invention and work. So I think the novel will survive just fine.
Because the novel that they're talking about with A.S. Byatt is the English language novel or the European novel.
Right.
But there are so many other storytelling traditions in the
exactly.
world that we really haven't paid enough attention to. I'm particularly fascinated by some of the Asian ones. But
yes.
Africa also is so rich in storytelling.
Indeed. So
we're starting to see it in the movies.
Absolutely. So I think that will continue to happen.
Thank you so much for being on our show. James Mustick, Mustich. His book, 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, a life-changing list. It's from Workman Publishing. And also, you can go to his website and enter join in the conversation.
Absolutely.
And maybe find some other books.
Exactly right. And tell us about the ones you love.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to James Mustick, to Deborah Freeman, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.